This is the World Teacher Podcast.
Welcome to episode 17 of the World Teacher Podcast. This episode is honestly really interesting. It combines one of my favorite topics, self-directed learning, with one I know very little about but have always found intriguing, which is unschooling. Many educators take as axiomatic the goal of creating self-directed learners. But what if the best way to achieve such an end isn't through school at all? What if school actually functions to thwart processes of self-discovery, self-determination, and self-actualization rather than facilitate them? Might unschooling or homeschooling provide a better way? The research might surprise you. It certainly surprised me when I first saw it. The findings so far are essentially that kids who don't go to school are, well, fine. In fact, the research indicates that such kids do neither better nor worse in terms of job satisfaction and financial success than kids who did go to school, but in terms of positive mental health outcomes, the unschooled and homeschooled kids are actually much better off. That should give one pause, I think. Furthermore, in the context of COVID, where for many parents the educational options still seem rather dire, it might be the case that more options are available than seemed plausible at first. It's at least worth thinking about. My guest today is certainly one of the most interesting people to discuss these topics with. Not only is she an expert in self-directed learning, unschooling, and homeschooling as a professor who specializes in these areas, she also unschooled her own child to become a happy, well-adjusted, and successful adult. In these areas, my guest is indeed Praxis Incarnate. Her name is Gina Riley. Dr. Riley is an educational psychologist, clinical professor, and program leader of the Adolescent Special Education Program at City University New York Hunter College. Even if you think school is sacrosanct, and to do anything other than to send one kids to school is silly, I really recommend paying close attention to Gina Riley anyway. She might just open your mind. This is me and Dr. Gina Riley. So Dr. Gina Riley, thank you so much for coming on and for meeting me. We've met only once previously, and it was a wonderful experience for me personally. So I really appreciate you taking the time today.
You're so kind. I am so happy to be here.
Thank you. So your research is really quite interesting, and it's in a kind of multiple different places. A lot of your work focuses on trying to understand human motivation and the relationship between that and learning. And you do a lot of work trying to understand and trying to put into effect self-determination theory in particular, which is kind of like the broad theory or almost sets of theories put forward by DC and Ryan many, many years ago that those of us in the educational world who understand really see a lot of value in. What is your take on self-determination theory, and to what extent do you think it is important for educators and parents to understand this when thinking about educational opportunities for people? And indeed, how important is it for young people themselves to understand this?
Yeah, it's such a great question because it is the most important. So I fell in love with self-determination theory in the early 2000s. And Edward Deci and Richard Ryan at the University of Rochester created self-determination theory in 1985. And it really had its like heyday in the early 2000s when Martin Seligman did the whole positive psychology thing and shifted really psychology from this study of weakness and this study of diagnoses to the study of strength and the study of happiness. And that was a great big shift that was much, much needed.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And at the time, I mean, I remember reading an article in the New York Times Magazine about self-determination theory and thinking, my gosh, this is how I want to live my life. And not only is it how I want to live my life, but it's really how like I want, you know, at the time I was a young mother and I wanted, it's really how I wanted my son's life to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a life where you get to wake up and really live intrinsically, loving what you're doing and living with such passion and joy. And so that was really the decision. And that just, you know, I was doing my master's at the time and I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is the thing. Like, this is the thing I want to study my whole entire life. Mm-hmm. And luckily I've been able to do that.
That's amazing. Oh. So what is it about it that really speaks to you so strongly?
Yeah, it's the whole like living through your intrinsic motivations, which means your intrinsic talents and your intrinsic strengths and your intrinsic joys. I was never one to be motivated by money per se. I was never one to be motivated by the alarm clock. I really wanted to live a life that I really enjoyed and loved. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's attractive about self-determination theory, right? It focuses on intrinsic motivation and one's self-determination. And then, I mean, there's that sub theory of cognitive evaluation theory, and that really shows how others, right? You can't force intrinsic motivation because that would be extrinsic, but you can indeed facilitate an environment that really, really like seeks intrinsic motivation. And so I love cognitive evaluation theory because that showed others how to facilitate that environment. And we can talk more about that.
What for you is the best way to kind of facilitate intrinsic motivation? Is it something that you think needs to be facilitated, or is it something that just through opportunities will naturally arise, or is it some kind of mix of both?
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, especially with hobbies and things you love doing on a daily basis, you're highly intrinsically motivated to do those things. And then there's this cognitive evaluation theory, and that really focuses on the facilitation because we know that not everything is intrinsically motivating. There are things that we have to do in life sometimes that are not, that are much more extrinsic, right? I have to pay my mortgage, so I have to make money. And so therefore, money is sort of an extrinsic value, and it does have value in this society. Cognitive evaluation theory really speaks to me because it focuses on ways that we can facilitate intrinsic motivation. And these ways have been seen through education and through healthcare and through, self-help. And so the ways really are those three tenets of cognitive evaluation theory is that sense of competence, or giving individuals a sense of competence so they know their strengths and they feel confidence, right? The sense of autonomy, which is always based on freedom and choice, and a sense of relatedness, which is really unconditional acceptance and love and support. So having those three things in what I call a toolbox is really the essentials to being able to facilitate intrinsic motivation. Because again, some things are just naturally not intrinsically orientated.
So if you were looking at somebody who isn't necessarily intrinsically motivated to do something, would you then look at whether they're autonomously making choices and whether or not they feel competent and whether the task is maybe too challenging or too boring and not really in that Goldilocks sweet spot, and or whether they feel like they belong and are psychologically safe in an environment?
100%. I mean, I talk about this all the time to my teachers, right? My teachers are living in a world that is very extrinsic. Schools have positive behavioral supports. They are expected to give grades. And so there's that real extrinsic piece to the traditional school system. And what I do tell my students who are teachers is that, you know, to facilitate that intrinsic motivation is really the magic of teaching. And it's the magic of education. Mm-hmm. To make sure your students are feeling competent, to make sure your students are feeling like they have choice and freedom in what they're doing. And of course, to have students that really, you know, feel a sense of unconditional acceptance and love. Mm-hmm.
And isn't it the case that the claims of self-determination theory go even further? And it's not just that they see these as like necessary elements for intrinsic motivation, but that in the absence of these, learning is thwarted, but also well-being itself is thwarted. So then what is the relationship between, say, agency and mental wellness?
The more freedom and choice people have, the more they tend to feel control over their environment. Mm. And we all know that our sense of well-being is really, it sits in that place. It sits in the ability to be able to control our environment. There's so much outside that we can't control, right? We can't control this pandemic that's happening now, and we can't control the political scene, and we can't control specific things in our lives. But to focus on the things that we can control and to focus on the things that create happiness and joy and well-being in us is really, really healing, and creates a sense of well-being and health. And, you know, there's a huge bunch of literature with regards to self-determination in the medical field, right? The more health and wellness and joy people have really equates to also the sense of agency and autonomy and freedom they have.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with this. I've worked in all sorts of different teaching contexts, those that are very traditional and those that are rather progressive and self-directed. And you see huge differences, not just in learning and in educational outcomes, but definitely in terms of just basic mental well-being, the ability to go through the day without deep levels of anxiety or depression. And these rates are really, really climbing for the Generation Z kids in particular. And that's often attributed to social media. And there seems to be good, like, explanatory reasons for that. But I think that schools, certainly, if they're not helping with it, they're probably exacerbating this in lots of different ways. And how do you see traditional forms of schooling as potentially undermining self-determination?
Yeah. And again, I want to stress that the system tends to undermine self-determination, because mm-hmm. the system of school and most school systems are built upon extrinsic motivators like grades and gold stars, positive behavior supports, and kids getting trophies each and every time everything is done. So it's never the teachers, it's never the building or the staff, it's the system that creates this dependence on extrinsic motivators. I know I teach teachers, and I know that teachers would love to have this system that really depends on a student's intrinsic motivations. But again, just as extrinsic motivations, they do work in the short term, and they're very effective in the short term. Right? Longer lasting focus on intrinsic motivation takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of structural change. Mm. So it's not that schools are bad per se, it's that the system perpetuates this notion of extrinsic rewards, grades, test scores. And that sort of system, I wonder if it'll change in the near future, but that sort of system is, you know, provide sort of this unhealthy context where we do things dependent on other things.
Yeah, for instrumental reasons. And I've definitely been a purveyor of that kind of educational experience for kids, and feeling very proud of it, and help the kids get the fives on the APs or whatever, and get them into the best schools in the United States. And then when they get there, they don't necessarily have the skills to be able to deal with the social and emotional challenges of being a human being outside of a very fixed kind of like system where everything was about getting grades. And that really, really, really troubles me. If even like some of the strongest kids, students in the world aren't able to live lives of wellness and flourishing, then I think we're doing something really, really wrong.
Yeah, it really comes to, what do I do, right? I lived in the system, right? I thrived in this system of getting good grades and of, you know, getting good test scores. And then it comes to real life and you're just like, oh my gosh, what do? I don't know really how to make decisions. I don't even know really what I want. Yeah. And that's hard.
Yeah, no, it is hard. It's really challenging. I feel like I've had maybe a positive influence in like a lot of my students going off into education and into things in like international relations and social justice related things, but maybe I was indoctrinating them too. Maybe they would have taken very, very different routes. Maybe they would have become dancers or something, and maybe that would have been better. It's impossible to really know. And I think that there's an arrogance in the schooling project itself that kind of determines what matters for kids to learn and what not to learn. And to the extent that we can help them make autonomous, authentic choices around their own learning, not only are they more motivated, but they figure out who they are. And that's crucial. Like, what if you're 45 and you don't know who you are yet and what you want to do, you need to figure that out. It's important.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's really, really important for us to remember is that the system has worked in the same way for pretty much all its creative life, right? We have this traditional school system, we've always had grades, we've always had test scores, and we've always depended on it. What's really come across during this time of COVID and the pandemic is that, my gosh, people are home. And so when you're home, even if you're doing remote schooling or whatever you choose in terms of schooling, you have, number one, a lot of time to think, right? And that thinking time is really important. Like if you're creative, we know that that thinking time is essential to any sort of creative process. So you have time to think, and you also have time to do things that you may have not ordinarily done. So you see a lot of kids now not only making TikTok videos, which are fantastic, but they also but also doing stuff like baking bread or learning that they love cooking or learning that they love skateboarding because they have a lot of time outdoors,
or learning they love their little sister.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Or even that they like their moms, right?
Yeah.
This person is really fun to hang out with. So it's my hope, and it really is my hope, that we see those things and we don't lose sight of them when things, quote unquote, go back to normal, that we see those things and we really transfer them to that traditional school system.
Yeah, I really hope so too. And I do see a lot of hope there, but I'm also aware that once people go back, whether they're teaching or whether they're students into that system, all the incentive structures, direct thinking and time and energy and emotion in particular ways, and away from other things. And that, like, unless people see this as an opportunity to like adapt and innovate and affect positive change, even if it's on a very micro scale, I think we'll more likely go back to like the status quo of not really a great system for most kids. You have a very, very different approach as a parent and also as a researcher to understanding education is not solely existing within schools. And you've done a lot of research on both homeschooling and unschooling. What are those? What's the difference between homeschooling and unschooling? And why might somebody want to do that? And why is that not a totally crazy thing to do?
Yeah, so homeschooling is really school at home. So with homeschooling, you have a curriculum. It's either bought or packaged or given by the school district. And you do spend a particular amount of time in that curriculum, and you take tests and you take standardized tests and you do all the normal things that you would do in a classroom, except at home. And unschooling is a type of homeschooling, and it's really about learning through life. It's really taking that packaged curriculum or box curriculum and sort of setting it aside for a little bit and looking at students' strengths and interests and talents and learning through that. Unschoolers tend not to really lean on things like grades or tests, and unschool parents know their children are learning by watching their children, right, grow and change and thrive. And so again, I love all educational choices, but there is a distinct difference between homeschooling, which is more school-like, and unschooling, which is more lifelike.
So homeschooling, would it be like more facilitated with like, I don't know, say maybe online courses or textbooks and resources and some kind of like homeschooling based curriculum maybe, whereas unschooling is kind of just like, do what you want?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that people unschool in different ways and people homeschool in different ways. And some people, I think, in the homeschool community are probably more unschoolers than they'd like to think. Homeschooling is really curriculum based, whereas unschooling really is intrinsically motivational based. And I think that's the core difference. There are things to do in homeschooling, whereas in unschooling, you really do get to guide and create your life.
Got it. Interesting. So you've done quite a bit of research looking at the experiences of unschoolers as they've entered adulthood. And so what is it like? So I'm sure that as people hear this, they'll be like, well, my kid will just be playing video games all day and not learning anything. But there are lots of people who actually have gone through life like this, and including your son. And by the way, I read the article that he wrote that you sent me. It was really interesting. It turns out that you can be okay if you don't go to school.
I mean, it's so interesting, right? I have that personal perspective, which I try to separate from my research perspective, but it does all intertwine. I unschooled my son from birth to college, which means he never went to school until his first day of college.
Wow.
And I mean, it was, you know, we referred to it as, and probably everyone around me referred to it as Gina's big educational experiment. But then later on as a researcher, you learn that, you know, I wasn't the only one and that others were doing this same thing. And hey, the kids turned out okay.
Not just okay, but it, it sounds like you have a great son.
I have a fantastic human being. I mean, he is the best. He has grown to be such a intelligent and creative and really beautiful, kind, caring young adult. And I'm sure every parent says that about their child. You know, but in terms of my son, the educational experiment worked out. He's in his second year of grad school. He's a music educator, and he really lives a life that he loves. And as a parent, that's really all you can ever ask for. And I think in the research, we saw very similar things. Dr. Peter Gray and I surveyed 75 young adults. And this is after doing a large study of unschooling families. So we did this large scale study of 232 unschooling families. And we're going through the data and we're thinking, wow, these outcomes are good, right? It wasn't what we expected. We kind of expected, you know, you get good outcomes, you get poor outcomes, and they sort of mesh together. So then we thought, geez, we really want to see if these unschooling families and mostly mothers were telling the truth. Right? Like, you have this data and you're like, is this life as joyous as it seems? Mm-hmm. And so we did these qualitative studies on 75 young adult unschoolers. It turned into two articles, one that was focused on higher education and career, and one that was focused on sort of the unschool experience. And what we found out was that 72 out of the 75 young adults had lives they really loved, lives where they were thriving and lives where most were financially independent, which we thought was really interesting. Lives where they were working on all sorts of careers, but tended to be more entrepreneurial or tended to be more STEM-based. And then you had the three, and I always think it's important to talk about the three, who felt that unschooling really wasn't so great for them. The three tended to have more controlling mothers. They tended to be part of religious communities that had very traditional rules, and they felt like their life was put on pause with unschooling and they had to catch up.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I think it's interesting to look at, right, negative outcomes as well as positive.
Sure, absolutely.
But the large majority of our young adults had really interesting lives. They felt that the freedom and independence that came from unschooling created this really nice transition to adulthood. They felt like their work really followed their intrinsic motivations, which I always think is interesting, right? So what they did and what they loved as a kid maybe turned out to be like these adult jobs that they've created for themselves or that they've gotten or that they've worked for. And they also felt very, very much that they loved their childhood, that they loved the schooling experience that they had in terms of unschooling, and that they felt freer and more autonomous. Everything you see in self-determination theory and cognitive evaluation theory showed up in that study.
Very, 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 very interesting. And I would say like very optimistic. It sounds like cool. In particularly in the context of COVID, because I know a lot of parents are really worried about like learning loss and like because at least in Ontario, it's not going so well. To put it as charitably as humanly possible, it's not going super well. People are trying their best, but it's a very, very difficult situation. And I know parents, I have friends who are worried about their kids getting behind. And then we have like these global reports from McKinsey or whoever, who don't know anything about education, by the way, who say that like these learning losses are going to equate to billions of dollars in lost revenue. As though I'm like, I don't care about that. But I do care about like the anxiety that can contagiously spread from parents to kids based on their maybe false perceptions of what might happen. And it sounds like your research points to more hope in this kind of situation. Maybe that if we let kids learn on their own, or even if they're not necessarily learning through the curriculum, they might still be learning.
Yeah. So what I think is really interesting is when COVID first hit, there was like that 2-week pause, right? Where nothing happened. So schools had to make plans, or at least New York schools had to make plans for some sort of schooling. And so they called this 2-week pause the reimagining. And I was hopeful during that point.
You're hoping it was a reimagining. I'm
like, this is going to be unschool, right? Like, we're going to go. But I knew better, right? I'm a teacher educator. I know how this is going to work. The reimagining turned into shifting school to just another place, remote school, right, on the computer, thinking that this was exactly the same as traditional school. But as we know, nothing is the same. The context is not the same. The background is not the same. The privacy is not the same. And kids don't act the same in a classroom than they would in a home. So nothing now is the same. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I see and hear reports of remote schooling and the lost year, I'm just thinking, no, it's not the lost year, right? We've been doing things differently, and maybe that hasn't worked out, but that's telling us something, right? So in a school structure, that's telling us that we have to reimagine and reinvigorate some structures, like tests that you can't take, right? Or like, you know, the whole point of being in school on the computer from 8 to 3, which probably or has to be unhealthy.
It's incredibly exhausting.
It's just
at the very least, at best, it's exhausting, but it's not good.
Yeah. And like, you know, the whole device situation and the equity situation, you know, how are we going to get individuals in low-income communities access, equal access? How are we going to give kids with disabilities access to their education over a screen? And so there are all these things that make remote schooling. I mean, listen, I've been involved in the field of distance learning and online education for 20 years. I love this stuff. I live and breathe this stuff. I love remote schooling. I love online learning. I love online distance education. I think it's here to stay forever, but not in its current form, right? You can't expect kids to just look at someone in a camera from 8 to 3 and live a thriving life. So the hope really is, and I think it's the hope for all of us in alternative education, that we look at this year not as a lost year, but as a year with opportunity, a year that's taught us something, right? I mean, you know, the slide and the grades, is that what's most important? Are kids happier? Are kids feeling more attached? Those are the studies I want to see. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is all in the context of a global pandemic. So if there is a slide, I mean, part of this slide has to do with the stress of living in a global pandemic, right? And even with the happiness, I'd love to see happiness numbers. I'd love to see more studies on well-being, more studies on mental health. But you know that it's going to be a little tinged because we're going through a hard thing. We don't like hard things in society. We want everything to just go well and beautiful and structure. Yes. But I really do hope this year is not a lost year. I hope instead it allows us to reimagine education. I hope it allows us to look at structures like free schooling and unschooling and see how we can bring it into the traditional school system, right? Like, what parts of unschooling really work and what parts can we bring into the traditional school system?
What parts would you bring into the traditional school system?
Of course, the focus on intrinsic motivation, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, the leaning into student strengths and student interests to shape any sort of curriculum. I hope that school systems really take this learning through life thing seriously. We call it generalization, and it's wonderful when kids can generalize lessons to their everyday life, but it's even better when the lessons are within their everyday life, right? So it's not Absolutely. A separate step where kids have this lesson and then they generalize it. Instead, it's really, I generalize everything because I'm living this. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to see more of that, more intrinsic motivation, more interest-based learning, more really seeing kids based on who they are and not the grade they get on a test.
Yeah, I'm 1000% with you on that. I think it's very tricky within like a very highly rigid curricular structure to be able to introduce those kinds of elements, because they require a degree of agility and responsiveness to like an individual student that really isn't present in most school systems and almost impossible to do at scale, unless you have like, maybe digital technologies will allow it eventually. I think they probably will, but only if we have the right emphases. And I really think wellness needs to be at the heart of absolutely everything we do. If you were asked by parents, as I imagine you must have been at some point during this crisis, whether homeschooling or unschooling might be a good solution for parents who are struggling, trying to deal, like, do I keep my kid at home and online learning? Do I send them into the school with potentially COVID? The online experience is not working for my kid. Would you recommend that they consider this? And if so, what might be some of the steps or considerations you'd have to take into account in order to transition to this totally different approach?
My answer to those questions has always been, you have to do what works for you and your family. Mm-hmm. And so homeschooling and unschooling may not work for a majority of families, right? Because to homeschool or unschool, you have to create structures that allow you to work, but also be with your child. And listen, it's hard to do it. I've done it. I was a single mother when I unschooled, and I worked and I went to school and I unschooled, and I was a single mother with no money. So I know.
Yeah, how do you do that? That sounds like,
how did you do that? You know, it was a matter, just like everyone juggles, right? I just juggled. I was a poor single mom. My son came first always. I just wanted to create this best life for my son. For whatever reason, I knew I had one chance. So there's one chance I wasn't going to waste. He was a really curious kid. And I was just like, well, let's try it. And every year it was sort of like, let's try it. It wasn't like I thought I was going to do this for the rest of his childhood and adolescence. Mm. Every year it became a conversation. Do you want to do this for another year? Do you want to try something else? Sometimes, you know, of course it would be easier sometimes if there was like a try something else that would allow me to work more traditional hours, but there wasn't ever. And so I took that and I was like, kind of like, yeah, okay. Like I only have this amount of years, let's do it. So I did, I juggled. I brought my son into college classes. My mom used to watch my son. But again, I chose jobs. One of the reasons I got into distance education so early was because I couldn't depend on my family or my parents for more than, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day, because they had their own lives and their own work. And so I really had to create a structure where I could be home. And the only way I could be home was to get involved in this very, very beginnings in 20 years ago of distance learning, where more colleges were offering classes. And I jumped on that because I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I can be home with my kid and I could work and I could teach and I can make money and I can go to school. So I just changed structures. And it was really a changing of structure, work structure, financial structure. Everything sort of was turned on its head. I was living COVID-19 life in the year 2000 when there was no COVID-19, right? So this particular structure of life feels very familiar to me, the working from home, the juggling multiple things, juggling family and laundry and kids, you know, that feels very familiar to me because that's the life I lived for so long.
Interesting. So what does unschooling actually look like on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis? Or what did it look like in your situation? I imagine it changed year by year, but are there certain patterns that were just evident throughout, or are there certain things that like, okay, you wake up and you're going to do this? Or is it just like, I have no idea. Like, what does a day actually look like?
Yeah. So for us, the day was totally focused on interests and strengths. So for most of the day,
interests and strengths. Okay.
Really focused on interests and strengths. Cool. So, and of course, people go through, you know, pockets of interest and strength at a particular time. And so, you know, early on, it was just about playing Legos all day. And then later it became about geology and like this obsession with rocks. And later it became an obsession with golf. And then even later, it became an obsession with guitar and like really the majority of the day was spent doing that. And of course,
so going deep into one thing that they're just super into at that time.
Yeah, it
awesome.
Does look like that. And mm-hmm. you know, we lived in New York State, so we had a core curriculum that we had to follow too. And I tease and I say we had all the textbooks and they were laying on our living room table. And it was just to kind of impress people. But I mean, did we look at them? Sure. Once in a while, we would go through and find out what was interesting to us and go through. Sometimes unschooling looked like reading the New York Times and talking about it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes unschooling looked like cooking together. Sometimes unschooling, a lot of times unschooling looked like taking walks and just sort of exploring nature and figuring out, like, you know, walks are time to figure out what you love, what you don't love, talk things out, things like that. In the teenage years, again, unschool looked a lot like playing guitar all day, every day. And that led to his current career. So, wow.
How did you guys eventually get him into university?
Yeah, so this is so interesting, right? Everyone thinks that there's one path to university.
A very, very hard path that is horrible, and just a million essays in your last year, totally focused on that. And it's really stressful for kids. It's not an enjoyable process at all.
Not at all. And so what we know from our research, right? So sometimes research mirrors your life. And in this case, research mirrored my life, is that unschooled kids do many different things to go into college. They might use community college as a stepping stone. So the mm-hmm. kid takes, you know, some community college classes at the age where they can, usually between 16 and 18, they have a community college transcript, and then they go transfer to a four-year university. Sometimes it looks like getting your GED and getting those SAT and ACT scores and applying sort of traditionally. Sometimes it looks like portfolio-based, you know, admissions, where the student has this portfolio of learning that they've done throughout their high school years of homeschool. And they go in and they show people the portfolio and they say, here's what I've done for 4 years. And sometimes it looks, you know, more traditional than you think, where a homeschool or unschool mother will prepare a, or father will prepare a homeschool transcript that then goes to the university. You explain to the university that you're a homeschooled student, and then they have specific structures like interviews or some sort of transcript assessment or admissions test that you go through. So it's just different paths, right?
But possible.
But 100% possible. Interestingly, I get more requests. I don't know why they think I would know, but, you know, Princeton, Yale, I get more requests like, how do I recruit homeschool students? How do I recruit these unschoolers? Where are they? Where can I find them? Because the colleges really love that sort of intrinsically motivated learning that came from life. So there's many, many ways to get into college. And my son's path, he had a portfolio, he had sort of this like conversation with the program coordinator of the program and said, listen, I'm really interested in this, I don't have a traditional background, what do I do? The coordinator told him the steps and he got in. So very, very, you know, different. There's not just one path, and there's not just one path in anything in life.
Yeah, I that makes a lot of sense to me. One of the objections I imagine parents might have, or like concerns about that, that you often hear actually, whenever you talk about almost anything progressive in education, is like, well, they need to be prepared for life, and life is hard. And like, you have to deal with loss, you have to deal with a competitive world, you have to deal with like these kinds of things. And how would you respond to that? Is it the case that kids don't learn about those things through unschooling?
I would say that it's the opposite. I would say that in unschooling, you have the open door to life because you are living in it. No unschoolers' lives are perfect, just like no traditionally school kids' lives are perfect. People get sick, they get divorced. Personally, my husband had cancer probably for 5 years out of the time when we were unschooling. So I got married when my son was 11. And probably between the ages of 12 and 16, my son had a front door to cancer and a stem cell transplant, which was not a fun door to have open. But he also had a door to resilience and healing. And he had a door to watching me budget during that time and to, you know, life. So unschooling is not shielding people. And I think that most people think that homeschooling and unschooling is about shielding people from life. And really, you know, that is not the truth. Homeschooling and unschooling is about opening that door to life. When you're in school all day, a lot happens in your house that you might not know about. When you're unschooled, you can't escape the stuff that happens in your house. And that's really something that I bring up all the time, because I think of people who might be housing insecure. I think of people where unschooling might not be the right fit. And so there's a lot of choices here. It's not like unschooling is the way to go. It's not like homeschooling is the way to go. And it may not be the traditional or private or charter schooling is the way to go. You just have to make the best choice for your particular family. There is not one most wonderful thing about any of these things. There are pros and cons to each and every one.
How do you think parents might better make those choices?
You have to
to what extent should they involve the kid in those choices, do you think?
All the time. So you have to know your kid really well. And I think whenever you're making choices for your child, you do. You lean on that child, and you have to know their interests and their strengths and their weaknesses and what they struggle with. And you have to involve kids in a decision. I think one of the things I've seen as an adolescent special educator and as a teacher of teachers is that we don't involve kids and teens too much in everyday decisions. We give them a lot of direct instruction and we give them a lot of knowledge, but we don't really sit down and have conversations that start with, what would you like? Because that's scary, right? But what I would, the message to parents and teachers would be, look at your kids and ask the question, what would you like? You might not be able to give them what they like, but you can certainly negotiate, right? And you can certainly think about their views and opinions and integrate them into yours, because kids are people and their opinions and choices have to be respected.
Kids are people. Yeah, I really love that. It's easy to forget that kids are human beings and they have rights and needs and their autonomy matters. And if we want to grow good people and have a healthy, happy society, it's really important that we encourage people to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
And that's not going to happen if we deprive them systematically of choices.
Right. If you don't allow that at younger ages, they're certainly not going to find out who they are at the older age. It just gets harder and harder the less autonomy and freedom we give.
Mm-hmm. How about socializing? How is it that parents of home and unschoolers facilitate social opportunities for kids? Because that's really, really important. And I imagine, well, in my view, just doing it online would not really be a good thing. It's really important to have human-to-human contact.
Yeah, and I think that the myth about homeschoolers and unschoolers, and we've seen this myth in research and literature, is that these are unsocialized kids, and they really are not. Just because they don't socialize within a classroom of same-age peers does not mean they're unsocialized. But their social lives do look different than individuals within traditional school. So of course, if you are a third grader in a traditional school, you have a lot of friends who are 8 years old, right? And you have your teacher, but most times you're like talking and hanging out with these 8-year-olds. And when you look at an 8-year-old unschooler, they're hanging out with a lot of people of a lot of different ages. So it might be their family, it might be their neighbor, it might be like playgroup and whatever they do. Also, a lot of homeschoolers and unschoolers have created these groups, right? Where kids go to parks and kids go to nature centers and kids go to museums and do art classes. Also, we have to remember that there's a whole world after school. It's not like school is our primary socialization place. There's sports, there's music, there's 4-H, there's Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and drama and all of those things that homeschoolers and unschoolers participate in on a daily basis. So we're not talking about kids who are, again, sheltered and not socializing. Although we will say that their socialization circle will be really ripe with what we call age mixing. So they have friends of a variety of ages instead of maybe the third grader who only hangs out with his 8-year-old friends.
What do you see as the benefits of age mixing? And not just like for unschoolers, but even in like alternative like schooling models.
I mean, when we grow up, we don't just hang out with 45-year-olds. right? Mm. Like there's the benefit of age mixing. You learn to, first of all, you learn to code switch. So you learn how to talk to adults and then you learn how to talk to kids your age. You learn how to live life outside a classroom structure. You learn to live life, period. So that part of it, again, not a worry.
Interesting. Honestly, it just sounds like a very, very encouraging set of opportunities, though difficult. So like a lot of my parent friends have really, especially if they have young kids, really struggled in COVID just because they've got their job and they don't know how to necessarily adapt and create new structures in the home that can allow them to both do their job and also help the kids. But part of that though is also them trying to respond to helping the kids do online learning and that being really poorly facilitated and just like, what do we do? And then there's these worksheets and like, we can't get online today and all sorts of different things. So I wonder whether like a lot of that stress just comes from, well, one, not knowing how to adapt, not expecting it, not planning that on their own, not being autonomous in the decision to move to that, but also just in the barriers that have been put up that they've had to adapt to because of the, I don't know, idiosyncratic way that this has kind of rolled out.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when you think about your kids being home with you all day, there's a particular context that we think about that in. And the context is that that's not normal, right? That kids being home with us all day and integrated into our work lives is not normal. Because we've created structures where we put kids on the school bus, we go to work, we come home, we pick kids up, and the time from 4 to 8 is their time, and then they go to bed. So we've created those sorts of structures, and those are very, very mainstream structures. Global pandemic has turned those structures upside down. And so I think we're going to have to sort of normalize a co-working space together. Hmm. A lot of my son's time unschooling was really watching me work. And I'm not going to lie about that, right? A lot of his time, it wasn't like I was paying attention to him all the time, 24 hours a day. A lot of this was being patient while I was on a call or waiting outside an office door when I had to talk to a colleague. And so, you know, he was really my coworker. He became my coworker and we would work. And interestingly, he said that really helped him in his adult life because he watched people work all the time. So that's just like, just what you did when you, you know, when you became an adult, you worked and you worked in all the different ways that you worked. And you also played with your kid and you also ate and cooked together and did all these cool things together, but work was a huge part of it. And so it's really about shifting structures and shifting thought with regards to structures. Our kids have become our coworkers, and we really kind of have to think about how we might look at that if this doesn't end in the near future.
Yeah, super interesting. I love your emphasis on alternative structures. I think that's kind of crucial in terms of transforming like schooling, at least. What to you are some of the more interesting alternative models or school structures that you see out there, and whether they're free schools or agile learning centers or something like that? What do you see as the most interesting and hopeful?
Sure. I mean, there's so much to talk about here. So there's your free schools and there's your democratic schools.
Can you explain what those are?
Sure. So free schools and free schools and democratic schools are different, but free schools allow kids, basically a school where kids have full autonomy and choice over what they do. And then you have democratic schools where kids have full autonomy and choice over what they do, but there's also sort of this democracy-like structure in making decisions, in making rules, in creating structures for infractions and things like that.
Super interesting.
Yeah, it's so cool, right? I'm doing a study on a Sudbury school right now, which is sort of like a democratic school. And I'm so excited over the data that we've gotten from that study.
Can I ask what you're researching, or is it a secret?
So I don't want to say the particular school, but Peter Gray, sure. Kevin Curry Knight, and other colleagues and I are researching a particular Sudbury school and have asked, you know, they have a 40 question interview, and we're particularly interested in the experiences of graduates of that school and how adulthood looks like for them. So super excited about that study, because I think that's going to give us a lot of data on how these alternative structures work for kids who grew up in them. Then there's, I'm really interested in the public and private spaces where intrinsically motivated autonomous learning has occurred, because I think that's a real interesting structure in itself. So you look at things like the Independent Project at Great Barrington High School. The Independent Project was created by a student who just looked at his mom and said, like, you know, we're doing everything that our teachers tell us, but I need something else. So he, you know, mom said, do something about it. Kid went to his guidance counselor and said, you know, I want to create this time when we can do what we want to do and we can work on independent projects. And so they gave kids a semester and half a day to do so. And there's so many interesting things that came out of Great Barrington High School during that time. I have a colleague, David Lane, who took that in an itty bitty form, wanted to see what projects and independence and autonomy would look like in a group of teens, and asked his principals for one period a day. Can I just have one period where kids have the free time to do whatever they want? And again, such interesting stories come out of that. I mean, some kids, did they sleep? Yeah, some kids took that one.
Maybe that's what they needed.
I mean, right, maybe that's what they needed. Some kids took that free time to sleep. Some kids journaled. Other kids really worked on projects. There's this fantastic story. It's in my book, Unschooling, Exploring Learning Beyond the Classroom. And one of the projects in David Lane's one period a day was this kid who was grieving his dad. And so for the first 6 weeks of this one period a day, he just spent like moping because, my gosh, he lost his dad and it was awful. And he needed that grief time, right?
And thank God he got that.
My gosh, right? Like, you ask yourself, this is social emotional learning at its finest. Yeah. Like, he had time to grieve. And then he sort of just woke up one day and he said, you know, my dad loves surfboards. I want to try to make one.
Awesome. I love that.
That's right. Beautiful. I mean, come on. Yeah. And so he goes and he goes to a surf shop and he figures out the materials. And, you know, at the end, he's like so disappointed because he didn't make a surfboard. He made a skimboard and he was so angry. Like, I set out to make a surfboard and here I make this skimboard. And so David asked him, you know, well, what'd you do? And he said, well, like, I know it's the wrong, like, I used the wrong mixture of chemicals and I know the fiberglass and I know this happened, you know, incorrectly. And I know I should have done this better. And David's like, did you learn that? And he's like, yeah, I mean, I know what I need to do better next time. And that's the greatest success of any project that came out of that one period a day. Here's a kid got, you know, that grief and mourning time, made a project that honored his dad, and then learned from mistakes. I mean, what more can you ask from school?
Well, what I would ask is that they give him a chance and give him the resources to do it again.
Yeah.
So now he's tried, he had an authentically motivating, important, meaningful project that he designed himself. He went through the process of trying to figure it out. He reflected on it, realized the shortcomings. And now this is where most of that learning is really going to come. Try it again, like apply that and then reiterate. And then if you then reflect, see what mistakes you've done and keep going. And eventually you'll become really good at making surfboards unless you stop caring. Maybe he'll get to a point when it's enough because it was really more about processing the emotional experience rather than the surfboard itself. And either is fine. So long as there's authentic growth, and that is very pro-human growth. It's very humanizing education. I think that's very, very beautiful. And if we can create structures that allow that to be replicated organically and naturally, beautiful. And that's a very small change. That's not this massive shift in, like, we're going to fundamentally alter everything in schooling. That's creating a little bit of space for humans to be humans.
That's amazing. And that's all I think, you know, if we're going to start one step to transform and reinvigorate and re-energize education, that's the one step we can take. An hour, 45 minutes. It's not a lot of time.
I love everything you have to say. It's very, very beautiful. How would you suggest that we... So, okay, you're like, we should transform structures. Let's create space. Let's facilitate intrinsic motivation. How do you see helping support kids in terms of social emotional learning as part of that?
Yeah, I think it's integrated within it. So anytime you're supporting, going back to self-determination theory and cognitive evaluation theory, anytime you're supporting a kid's sense of competence, a kid's sense of autonomy or freedom and choice, and a sense of relatedness or having unconditional acceptance or love for someone, then you are providing the structures for well-being, mental health, good social emotional learning. I mean, it's really that simple. We talk about social emotional learning in such a weird context in schools right now. So in New York, what's happening in New York City is schools are focusing on social emotional learning. And so they're doing things like 5 minutes of mindfulness before class, which is amazing. Listen, it's huge change, but it doesn't really get to the root of what real social emotional learning is, which is creating psychologically healthy human beings. Mm-hmm. We have to do more than that 5 minutes. It might be 30, it might be 45. I mean, mindfulness is wonderful, but it's not the whole picture. We have to be having conversations with kids. We have to be exploring their strengths and interests. Again, that comes up all the time, but that's what works. Mm-hmm. We have to be really, really focusing on our relationships with our students, if we're teachers, or our kids, if we're parents, and really seeing what comes and grows out of that. Like, we all know the best investment in our child's life is a good relationship with them. And so we need to create time to foster that.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've seen is that when you actually create like a structure within schooling that allows kids to go on their own individualized pathways, and you support the building of community to create psychological safety, and you reduce the like the all the incentives that give rise to constant like judgments of each other and this comparative social evaluation thing that creates incredible anxiety, you reduce or to as much as you can eliminate that. And then kids will see like, okay, this person's amazing at like, I don't know, at art, and this person's fantastic at science experiments, and it's cool. No one really cares. Like they stop putting each other down for difference when difference is normalized and celebrated and really encouraged. And we can and should be doing that, but it's not just freedom. It's you're really right. It's a relationships to create that safety.
Yeah. And kids need to see each other. Right. Just like you said, they really need to see each other, mm-hmm. their strengths and their differences, and appreciating those differences. Like in special education, there's such a separation between like gen ed kids and special ed kids. And, you know, they're just.
Why is that?
Yeah, well, because current structures have created this structure of DIS, D-I-S, ability, which means mm-hmm. you are bad at something because of an inherent thing that you might have, which is the most insane thing. And so, like, I love the field of disability studies, ability studies, which is really doing some great work in this forum where you're normalizing everyone. Right? Kids with disabilities, kids without disabilities, kids who like soccer and kids who like art. Everyone is okay and fine and has something to give to society. So we have to stop like separating. We're really separating, and we really have to start integrating.
Couldn't agree more. And we don't do that because it meets the needs of the kids at all. Let's be honest. That is not the reason. It's because it's easier for the teachers.
Yeah. I mean, again, everything that is structural, so extrinsic motivators, much easier, much quicker, not long lasting, right? Differentiation works for the lesson, wonderful for that particular lesson, not long lasting. So everything that we're doing is not long lasting, yet we expect people and teachers and kids to be able to generalize their learning to the real world when they don't get any time really in that real world. So there are specific structures, and it has to be a structural change. There are specific things that need to be changed if you want to change education as we know it.
How would you change assessment? Because assessment is this is a massive question. And
that's a great question. I'm actually really involved at the college level in assessment. And it's actually, I love assessment. I hate to say it, right?
Me too. No, it's fascinating if it's doing what it's meant to do, which is to drive learning.
Yes.
not to measure and sort.
Yes. So if it drives learning, it's wonderful. But most of our assessments are quantitative assessments. So they're numbers. And those numbers are never looked at in a holistic view. Those numbers are just looked at as a number. So if you got like this number on the SAT, you are automatically a good student, even though the SAT is not very reliable or not very valid. And if you got this number, then you're a poor student. We really have to attach meaning to numbers in the assessment world. And we have to attach numbers to specific situations. So for example, if you take a test, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning and you're 18 and you stayed up till 2 o'clock the night before 2 a.m., you know, chances are you didn't get enough sleep, you're tired and you're not going to really do well on the test. That number didn't say anything about what you studied. It just said that you were tired. Right. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to attach meaning to numbers, and we need to really move to a more qualitative, holistic assessment base.
I totally agree. It's a difficult thing to do if we're stuck within like a dominant curricular model, because that will absolutely dictate the assessment, that'll dictate the instruction, and then we don't have actual self-directed, intrinsically motivated learning anymore. But if, to the extent that we can engage peers in peer-to-peer assessments, and we can really teach kids to do authentic, self-honest self-assessment very, very well, based on their, especially based on their own learning goals. Once kids like get that and understand that like it's okay to do that, and it's not a secret, and the teachers aren't out to get you and give you enough if you do it wrong, then it's incredible, the power of assessment to really, really like help kids figure out, okay, where is it that they want to go? Where are they now? How do we bridge that gap? How do I help my friends do that? How do my friends help me do that? And it really creates a culture of like true, authentic, deep learning.
And that's what we want to do, right? Like we want to create a culture of learning, and we also want to create a culture of assessment, mm-hmm. Where we see assessment again as more holistic, peer-to-peer, more wide-ranging, more self-reflective, instead of this punitive structure of assessment that we've created.
Yeah, totally agree. One thing I'm really wondering, because I've kind of gone through all the topics that I wanted to ask, but I don't know what I don't know. What are my blind spots? What should I be asking about homeschooling, unschooling, alternative forms of education?
Yeah, no, you've gone deep and thorough, and I've so appreciated.
I'm okay. Did a good job as a podcast host. Thank
you. Most amazing job. So good. I think, you know, again, it's just a choice. So when people hear homeschooling and unschooling, I think sometimes it creates some sort of fear or some sort of my child's not going to be socialized and all of it. And it's just a choice. It's a choice as relevant as public, private, or charter schooling. And that's really the message that I want to get across. You know, when we were unschooling in the 90s and the early 2000s, it was like we felt very, very different. We felt very, very othered because we were making such a drastic decision. Wow. And so I just want people to see it as something that can really change education as we know it and really help with reforming and revigorating and reimagining education as a whole. Hmm.
And if a parent is out there who has a kid who's struggling within the dominant model, whether in COVID or otherwise, it might be worth thinking about. If parents were interested, or educators or whomever were interested in learning more, what would you recommend that they look up, search more about, or read?
Yeah, I mean, you know what's interesting? I always go back to history. Peter Gray's Free to Learn is so fantastic and tells
brilliant,
the history, yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Tells the history of, you know, really just education from hunter-gatherer period on. If you're interested in the more unschooly, intrinsically motivating stuff, it's all about John Holt and his writings, right? So you go deep into
Free to Learn.
I love all of them. Howard Gardner, his theory of multiple intelligences. He wrote this book called The Unschooled Mind. And I always think it's sort of like very much about unschooling, which he really didn't mean it to be like. But Howard Gardner is a good, very traditional view into what this might look like. And of course, I mean, I have to promote, because you spend so much time on a book and it's my baby right now. I wrote an academic book on unschooling called Unschooling, Exploring Learning Beyond the Classroom. And it really, I mean, it tells the story of unschooling. It's the first research-based book on unschooling, but it also ends with ways that unschooling can change traditional school structures. So again, you know, start with Peter Gray and move forward.
Awesome. Congratulations on that, by the way. I really want to encourage you to keep doing the work that you're doing. I think it's really important for the world, and I hope that you keep spreading the message. You're a great advocate for this, by the way, from all angles. You really, truly are. And I think what you're doing is really, really, really wonderful. So thank you. And thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time. I'm glad to have met you. You're a great human.
I'm so happy to have met you. Thank you so much. You also keep doing what you're doing. Keep spreading the word. Thank you. I'm so appreciative of you.
That was episode 17 of the World Teacher Podcast. I'm Gareth Manning. Huge thanks to Dr. Gina Riley. You are such a courageous and caring person. And you've definitely inspired me to learn a lot more.
Thanks for listening.